This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Who was the worst president? No, you're wrong. Author Robert Strauss says James Buchanan was the worst president ever, and I can guarantee none of you said that. Here come the emails. Anyway, the 15th president of the United States led the nation in the lead up to the Civil War, and Robert Strauss argues that his inaction may have been worse than anything he actually did in office. Robert Strauss will speak at several events later this month in North Carolina, but first he joins me on the State of Things. Robert Strauss, welcome.
Thank you very much, Frank.
We should point out the name of your book is Worst, period, President, period, Ever. And Ken Rudin is still on the line with us. You still there, Ken?
The worst guest ever.
No, he's referring to himself, just in case there was anything unclear about that, Robert. Not you. So how did set out to write this book?
Well, I was always obsessed by the presidents, and therefore I had this background in thinking about it. And James Buchanan was from Pennsylvania. I live just out of Philadelphia. And I found out that where I play basketball is a block from where his papers are. So that sort of started me thinking about it. And I thought that the worst was a better thing to look at than the best.
Yeah, but I mean, he's a president in an important time, right? His presidency ends in 1860. This is the run-up to the Civil War. This is perhaps the most, one of the most critical periods in American history. Obviously, it's an important time, but we don't think of Buchanan as either the best or the worst. How did you rate him with a superlative of any kind?
Well, every decision he made was bad. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, but so many other presidents. Well, keep going.
Okay. Well, I'll give you this. Okay, it starts out on the day after his inauguration, where a Supreme Court case that he influenced, the Dred Scott decision, comes down. He went behind the scenes to get a Northern justice to agree with the other Southern justice that the decision would be what it was, which essentially said that every state was a slave state. There's nuances to it, but that's effectively what it was.
And in that way, he was actually going against the will and the grain of his own party, right?
Correct. Well, in a certain sense. In a certain sense, because he was a Southern-looking Democrat from the North, he just went behind the scenes to ensure that slavery would continue to exist because he thought that was the way to save the Union.
All right, so that sounds pretty important. Ken Rudin, I wonder if you've ever thought about James Buchanan in this way when you read this book and thought about it.
Absolutely, there's no question. I mean, I think I think I'm bored with who are the best presidents. We could talk about the Washingtons and the Lincolns and the FDRs and Jefferson and all that, but I think it's more important to talk about the worst, and I think Robert is exactly right. The fact is that the nation, the Union was falling apart in such a critical time in this country. He could have shown some kind of leadership. You know, he comes into the presidency with great qualifications. He was a member of Congress. He was Secretary of State. He was the U.S. Ambassador to Great Britain. He had great credentials. And then he basically sits there and, one, he sounds like he's pro-Southern during much of his term, and he just basically says, well, let's see how it all pans out. He showed no leadership, and, of course, it led to obviously the disastrous Civil War.
Given the tensions in this country over slavery in that moment, Robert Strauss, can't leadership push you on one side or the other and end up the same way if you start favoring one side over the other and they feel very strongly about their point of view in that critical moment? How does leadership change the outcome? Any? You could lead them into an inevitable war anyway, right?
Well, I suppose you could. But in this case, there was a tide going against slavery. There were no more slave states to be had, except maybe Kansas. And that's where he screwed up too. There was a fight going on. There were two competing constitutional conventions, to to lead them into statehood, and he wouldn't make a decision there either, which caused the rise of John Brown, which made things even worse.
What should he have done, do you think?
He should have stood back in Dred Scott, obviously, and he should have chosen the non-slave convention in Kansas, considering there were about six slaves in all of the territory.
Yeah, Dred Scott, tell us more about that, about you know, his role in Dred Scott and how you think that made things much worse.
Well, of course, he went behind the scenes. The court was split much like it is now, except then it was Southern and Northern instead of conservative and liberal. So the Supreme Court decision, if it were a 5-4 decision, would have been ineffectual. But once he convinced his fellow Dickinson College alumnus, Robert Story, to go with the Southern group, then it became, and then another Northern justice wrote a concurring opinion, became 7-2, and that made the decision forthright.
So there he was. So there he was, a kind of activist. It wasn't inertia. In fact, it was overzeal that got him. I mean, overreaching in a sense that led to that disastrous outcome.
Right, and wouldn't have happened. And then what happened right after that was that the country went into stasis. He screwed up a 20-year economic boom. Fostered by the railroads, we had all this new territory, the Louisiana Purchase and so forth, and suddenly people just stopped. If you had your tin cup factory in Chicago and you sort of wanted to go to Cicero and have a second one, well, you stopped because you said, well, somebody from Tennessee can come up with slaves and be my competitor.
Frank,
so railroads went bankrupt. Ancillary businesses went bankrupt, and the Panic of 1857 started. It was the most precipitous decline in any time in our history. In fact, every bank in New York closed for a day.
Big bank holiday, but of course the Panic of 1857, as you say, one of the most disastrous, although certainly not the only. Ken Rudin, I know you had a question.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, Robert, we talked about maybe he was pretty aggressive in getting votes for the Dred Scott decision, and that's true, but I'm just wondering if he thought somehow Dred Scott and the battles about whether Kansas is a slave state or not, maybe that was his just way of just trying to put off the inevitable conflict in the Civil War that was coming, and maybe it was just his way of saying, look, I don't want to be involved in this, and maybe hopefully this will get me through my administration without having the country fall apart. But it just seems like that by saying, by winking and saying, well, these states did have a right to rebel, if not secede, he was just not showing leadership, and he was just saying, I just hope I can get through this thing.
Well, I don't doubt that. But there were too many of his actions that made it seem otherwise. For instance, when John Brown gets more and more popular and gets to Harper's Ferry, he just says, well, maybe the Virginia people will take care of it. And fortuitously, Robert E. Lee comes home to Arlington. He comes to Buchanan. He says, you know, this doesn't look very good over in Harper's Ferry, 40 miles down the road. And so he convinces Buchanan that he'll go out and take care of this.
Do you get the sense that James Buchanan understood the magnitude of the situation, that he saw the nation in crisis in a way that we now, looking back, can see it quite easily?
I really don't think so. I think that he thinks, after 40 years of service, that the country's bopping along and that slavery will eventually die out just like it did in many places in Europe. But it doesn't.
Well,
and that's his big thing.
What about the Panic of 1857? As you said, this was disastrous. And again, this is the moment of industrial capitalism that proves itself out over and over again. There's overproduction, prices fall, jobs are lost. There's just too much of it. Too many railroads and people have bought all the stuff they're going to buy, and now we're in trouble again. What was it that he should have done, or how do you think he was made things worse in that particular economic disaster?
Well, how he made things worse is this. He decided he would do nothing because he hated the speculators. He said, you know, let them die off or whatever they're going to do. We'll get through it with American grit. Somehow we'll overcome this. And we sort of did, because a few years later there were a lot of guns and bullets to be made.
That's how we get out of all those things, isn't it?
It seems so.
Well, speaking of guns, he also got us involved in a pig war.
Yes.
I didn't even know about this one.
What's wonderful about studying history is that when you're in high school, every president's got one line. You know, Washington threw the dollar across the Rappahannock, and you know, Lincoln freed the slaves. But we forget about all these little things. Well, there was this dispute up in Washington, what became Washington State, and a few settlers were up there, and one of the American settlers saw a wild pig coming on his property, and he shot it dead. Unfortunately, that pig was owned by the Hudson Bay Company, sort of the Koch brothers of their time, and they sort of ran Canada. Well, there's this standoff, and Buchanan decides to take several battalions out of Kansas where they were needed. Now, remember, there are only 12,000 soldiers in all of America. So they schlepped them up to Washington. Remember, they're not taking 747s. They're walking. And they finally get there. And, of course, when they get there, everybody shrugs their shoulders, and they're back to eating whatever they're eating. So that's one of his little disasters. You know, we invaded Paraguay. And there are several other things that happened during his administration.
Frank?
Yeah.
Let me just say, first of all, I think we also know that Donald Trump has been involved in the pig war, but that's a different thing altogether.
That's right.
But Robert, I want to ask you this question, too. You know, I was just a little kid when Buchanan was president, but when I think of people like Truman, Harry Truman and Jimmy Carter, they are both revered former presidents right now, and yet when they left office, Truman in 1953 and Carter in 81, their numbers were disastrous, but history has treated them better in the intervening decades. I don't see any kind of rehabilitation for James Buchanan in any history book ever, anywhere.
There really is not. One of the funny things, of course, is he did screw up the secession. He allowed seven states to secede, and he said, the Constitution doesn't allow them to secede, but I can't do anything about it.
Right.
You know, so then he goes back home to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, in his beautiful house. It's a beautiful house if anybody ever goes to Lancaster to go see it. And he starts writing his memoirs. Now, of course, memoirs had never been written before. I mean, Jefferson wrote about the state of Virginia and all that, but this was really a personal thing. But now the Civil War gets a little close. Gettysburg's not that far from Lancaster, and he fears for his life because people have come to his house and thrown rotten vegetables at it and written graffiti on his fences. So, I mean, you can't even imagine that now, but in the 1860s, that's what happened.
I think there should be more of that. I think that's the guy. But, you know, I also think about these things, and I know that this is a good way to get us, you know, looking at an important period of history. First of all, we had Whigs and we had know-nothings, which, you know, we still have know-nothing politicians. They just don't have the name anymore.
And we have a president. We have a presidential candidate with a wig.
So it's coming back. It's all coming back. But, you know, Gore Vidal used to love to say that he thought the worst president ever was John Kennedy. And, of course, this was shocking because everybody knew Gore Vidal was John Kennedy's personal friend, that he agreed with him mostly politically. He was an outspoken liberal. Why would Gore Vidal think John Kennedy, of all people, was the worst president ever? And he would say, well, look, he got us into the Bay of Pigs, and then after that, the Cuban Missile Crisis. My God, he was in office for only 1,000 days. If he'd have been in for another 1,000, he'd have had us all killed. You know, this is what, but I wonder if that was ever fair. I mean, he didn't get us into the Bay of Pigs. You know, Eisenhower did. These are longstanding kind of historical momentum that carries you into this. And same with the Cuban Missile Crisis. It's always easy to see a president sort of in these situations and saying, well, you know, they're the ones who did this to us. But I wonder if we're being fair to them by not recognizing, you know, all the buildup that led to all of this.
Well, you know, the 1856 election, if somebody wants to go out and look at it, is much more bizarre than ours. I mean, we had a party that called itself the Know Nothing Party.
I love that.
Can you imagine that? You know, and they were anti-immigrants. They were anti-Catholic immigrants, but anti-immigrants in any case. And
they nominated.
Yeah, they nominated a former Whig president, Millard Fillmore, only because he was the only one who would take up their cudgel, and only because he really wanted to get back in the White House. And then there was this other new party, the Republican Party, which met about six blocks from where I'm sitting here in Philadelphia, and they nominated a celebrity. The celebrity was a guy named John Fremont, the Pathfinder, the guy who went out through the West with his friend Kit Carson and mapped out the West in about four or five excursions. And he wrote journals about them, but they were dry. But he married the 17-year-old favorite daughter of Senator Thomas Benton, the longest-serving senator in the country. And she gussied up his journals, much like, I guess, Chris Kardashian to Bruce Jenner, and made this guy a celebrity. And he gets to run for president. Imagine that.
So the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Right.
Well,
By the way, I'm just looking on Twitter. When he mentioned Kim Kardashian, our rating just zoomed up. That was great.
That was Chris Kardashian.
Yeah,
but that's okay.
It's all good. Kardashian is good. Right. And may I just add Naked Kitten just to keep us in the top 10. Let me ask you this. Ken, I'll put this question to you and then Robert Strauss to you. This question of rating presidents, I mean, it is kind of interesting. Certainly their reputation changes from in their time when how people felt about them to the way we look back at them, Ken, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's why I mentioned Truman and Carter earlier, because when they left office and their final months in office, they were just thought to be just so ineffectual and just awful. And, you know, it's interesting about Gore Vidal and John F. Kennedy, too, because at the time, Gore Vidal was not the only one who said bad things about Kennedy, that he was reckless, that he was inexperienced, that he could have been more prepared for these things. But the difference, and I think what's fascinating about Robert's analysis, which I probably agree with, is that whatever you think about Kennedy and the Bay of Pigs, and certainly the Cuban Missile Crisis, he was not sitting back and saying, well, let's just see what happens. I mean, he was just, you know, on top of it 24/7, and obviously he probably rescued the world from a nuclear war disaster, whereas, as Robert points out, even as Buchanan is going out of office, you have seven states seceding from the Union, and he says, well, you know, what can I do? And that's pretty remarkable.
Well, Robert Strauss, what about you? And I guess part of that is the question of sort of how we look at these. But in particular, you came across Buchanan because he was sort of a neighbor. What did you learn about him, and what struck you as kind of the most interesting fact that you, as a historian, didn't realize?
Well, first of all, it was great experience. Probably the most experienced man ever to become president in government. Second of all, you know, there are good qualities. When you write a negative biography, you still have to acknowledge the good qualities. He was the best party giver in mid-19th century America. The inaugural ball was a signal event. And he had his first lady, quote-unquote first lady, because he was a bachelor president, was his niece, Harriet Lane. And she should be Lynn Miranda's next musical because she was the Jackie Kennedy of her age. Everything that she wore, everybody else wanted to wear. When there were trading cards with Harriet Lane. So he was a great uncle, so to speak. And he never said anything bad about anybody in print. I went through all of his papers. There's not a word bad about anybody. I mean, he obviously thought bad about people. He didn't support Stephen Douglas.
He's also the only president who never said anything bad about somebody's his mother-in-law. I guess that's what's good.
Because he didn't have one.
Because he didn't have one. That's right. Also,
however,
only bachelor president and only president from Pennsylvania. Did I read that in your book, Robert?
Correct.
Wow.
Correct.
There you go.
And you know, here's something else that would never pass muster.
Got to be quick.
Okay. His fiance committed suicide in Philadelphia.
Oh, my goodness. Didn't know that. And yes, and how could you be elected these days with that kind of baggage? Well, I want to thank you very much. Robert Strauss, author of Worst President Ever, going to be at Park Roads in Charlotte on October 29th, Flyleaf Books on October 30th. We've got all that stuff at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you. And Ken Rudin, thank you so very much, both of you, for being on our program.
Best host ever.
You're darn right.
Best host ever. Thanks a lot, Frank.
Just ahead, the music of the Piedmont Melody Makers. See, I'm not the best. They're coming up live on the State of Things. Please stay tuned.